Can Alaska survive with oil at $40 a barrel? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 31st of August. Good as always to have you here. Today, President Obama is visiting the state that oil built. He'll spend 3 days in Alaska focusing on the effects of climate change. A lot of those effects are most pronounced in the Arctic. And as we know, a lot of those effects come from burning oil and other fossil fuels. But Alaska is already suffering from the low cost of oil, so reducing its use even more is going to be a tough sell. For more, I'm joined by Scott Tong from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Molly. How are you?
I'm good. So what is happening in Alaska? It's obviously an oil-dependent state. Oil, a barrel of crude, is now barely $40. How bad is the economy taking a hit right now?
Well, here's the problem. The state government assumed that oil would be selling for $105 this year. Now, you just said it's selling today for about $40 a barrel, and so they have a big state deficit problem, and a lot of the state runs on government spending. Already, public schools are seeing their budgets cut at the university. They've had furloughs and they've had layoffs. But there's a larger, longer-term problem here, Molly, and that is Alaska's oil production has fallen to a quarter of what it was in the 1970s. Now, this oil flows through, we've heard of the Trans-Alaskan pipeline before to get to the port, to get to the tankers. And if the pipeline flow gets too low, that becomes a numbers problem. The oil gets cold, so you have to heat it up, or you have to pressurize it, or you have to dilute it. And it all costs money, so it's getting both short-term and long-term precarious for this oil state.
And if you are an oil state, like you said, how do you turn things around?
Well, they do some other things in Alaska. There's salmon and there are tourists. But the state budget relies 90% on oil. About a third of all jobs can be traced directly to petroleum. So it's an issue. I spoke this morning to Stephen Kopitz, an analyst at Princeton Energy Advisors, and he compared Alaska to Saudi Arabia as far as its dependence on oil.
You know, historically, Alaska has been a forgotten state before oil. You know, it's a very, very difficult place to live. It's very expensive. And really, it's one major natural resource is oil. So if you take away oil, the population that that state can support could decline quite materially.
So quite materially, what's it mean? Well, one Alaska economist said two-thirds of the population could get up and go if it really got bad. So I would call that quite materially.
Wow. And so what is the solution? It sounds like at least some Alaskans are promoting more Arctic drilling.
Well, one solution is you can try to diversify, but it's hard to find other things economically to do in Alaska. And as you mentioned, more drilling. You know, big oil has made a big bet up there. The Shell Corporation is drilling now in the Arctic. And if it strikes a big elephant field, right, that's another generation of prosperity for Alaska. That, of course, raises the big environment question. Even if Shell can pull this off, you know, big oil and us, the big drivers, created this warming, which they're already experiencing up in the Arctic. And this warming melts the ice, allowing for more drilling, which means more warming. So that's the problem. That's the president's case this week for future generations. The issue is this generation in Alaska. And their case is, well, you know, the road to a low-carbon world is a long one. We may as well drill in the meantime. That's their argument.
Scott Tong, thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, well, oil is up a little bit, but nothing else is. We'll have more when we do the numbers. As you've probably heard, a flood of migrants have been trying to make their way to European countries to escape conflict and poverty in their homelands. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said this month that Europe's refugee crisis is a bigger challenge to the EU than the Greek debt crisis. An emergency meeting has been called for September 14th. More than 300,000 people have crossed the Mediterranean this year alone, fleeing from Iraq, Syria, Eritrea, and Afghanistan. The migrant crisis has overwhelmed many countries. Hungary is one of them. It's constructing a razor wire fence along its border with Serbia to deter migrants. The BBC's Nick Thorpe visited the Hungarian-Serbian border to hear what people there think about the fence.
The refugees just keep coming. 50,000 in August, well up from the 38,000 in July. they're told by police to wait in this already harvested cornfield. Just before sunset, volunteers from a migration aid group distribute water and sandwiches. People sit on the ground in smaller or larger groups, waiting for police buses to take them to a registration centre. Nada is 27, from Aleppo in Syria. I asked her if she was travelling with her family.
No, family, bomba.
All your family was killed?
Yes.
Where are you going now?
France, Denmark, Germany, I don't know.
Just across the field, I met a group from the embattled Kurdish town of Kobane in northern Syria, where Kurdish fighters are still battling Islamic State. They spoke little English, but the children sang a song about their town for me. One of those handing out food and water to the refugees was Bolash Solai. I asked him what he thinks about the border fence and about the growing danger of the land route across Europe. The tragic incident last Thursday in Austria when 71 migrants suffocated in a Hungarian registered truck.
This accident, I think, blame everybody. These people don't have enough information what will happen in this country. If they know Hungary helped them in this situation, helped them to travel through the country and cooperate with the European Union, I think it's a solution to avoid these accidents and the smugglers.
But in this motorway services nearby, organized crime groups offer the migrants expensive and, it seems, increasingly dangerous trips on to Budapest or Western Europe. In the latest crackdown on the traffickers, Hungarian police have arrested Bulgarian, Polish, Lithuanian and Romanian citizens, as well as many Hungarians. Back near the border fence, the regional spokesman of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Baba Balos, criticised Hungary's new border fence and said that Hungary should do much more to help refugees.
This is a European country and asylum seekers shouldn't be turned back from anywhere. But on the other hand, we are asking not only from the Hungarians, from Europeans also, a robust system that works in helping these people. So far, that system is dysfunctional here.
The Hungarian border fence, known as the wire obstacle, is now in place, more or less, along the whole border with Serbia. In the coming months, it will be further strengthened. The government says it's in the front line of defending Europe. Its critics say that its approach to migrants is undermining the very European values it claims to want to protect.
Muhammad.
That was the BBC's Nick Thorpe. Back here at home, it hasn't been a great year for pay TV. Cord cutting and the fear of cord cutting led to a media stock price slaughter a few weeks back. And now there's a new threat facing cable companies, the future of the set-top box. Almost everyone who has traditional cable rents their set-top box from the cable company. That makes those companies a lot of money, but it doesn't necessarily give you the best deal or the best product. So an FCC advisory committee weighed in today with a report on how to encourage competition. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
If you don't want to rent a cable TV set-top box from your cable company, you don't have a lot of options, and it's kind of a pain. You still need to rent a card from your cable company to run the box. It's almost like the days when you had to rent your phone from the phone company. But Edgar Dvorsky, founder of the website Consumer World, says when that changed,
a market developed overnight. You could go to the store, buy a telephone. How come that hasn't developed the same way with cable companies?
Today's report from an FCC advisory committee comes up with two options for solving this problem. One would let you buy a cable box that could search for, say, your favorite movie. John Bergmeier, an attorney at the consumer group Public Knowledge, likes that idea.
you search for the name of a movie, and if it's airing on TV, it'll show you those results. But if it's on Netflix, it'll show you the movie result there.
Bergmeier says cable companies don't want cable boxes sending you to Netflix. They prefer a second option that could eventually replace cable boxes with an app. Brian Dietz is a spokesman for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. He says there are already lots of ways to get your cable.
There's never been more choice and competition for consumers and how they receive their content.
Still, some consumer advocates wonder why you can't just buy a set-top box like you'd buy a cell phone, or TV for that matter. This is something the FCC is still wrestling with. It's now in the information-gathering phase, accepting comments on the report issued today. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
While we're talking about TV and movies, today Hollywood is remembering the horror movie mastermind Wes Craven. He died Sunday at the age of 76. Craven wrote and directed 1984's Nightmare on Elm Street and all of its scary sequels, and he helped define the teen slasher genre that he later turned around and mocked in the Scream films. Among Hollywood investors, Craven was known for making big profits on small budgets. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on why Hollywood was such a fan of Craven and of horror movies in general.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming.
The first Freddy Krueger movie broke ground by offering a surreal twist on slasher films. Craven was innovative, but he also followed a decades-old Hollywood horror business plan. Big scares, low prices.
There's literally no relationship between the cost of a horror movie and how successful it can be at the box office.
Paul DeGarabedian is senior analyst at Rentrak, which measures audiences. Scary movies generally don't need pricey stars or locations.
You don't have to spend a lot of money, and that's why horror films are among the most profitable films of all time.
Famously made for around 15 grand, Paranormal Activity grossed nearly $200 million worldwide and spawned popular sequels. And horror movies have advantages in the digital era, says Tatiana Siegel at The Hollywood Reporter.
One of the things you'll hear theater owners tell you is that horror itself is one of those pirate-proof genres because people don't want to sit in their home and watch a movie like Paranormal Activity. It's too scary.
Horror also speaks to fundamental human needs, says Paul Patterson, who teaches an unusual graduate class at St. Joseph's.
The name of the course is Drag Me to Hell, Horror Films and Literature.
He says people across the ages flock to scary stories because they help us face our fears without being in real danger. Hollywood loves horror because we do, and because they can scare us dirt cheap. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was undoubtedly the best plan, but they lost like 8-10 grand in a month, at least.
Touring with the band has its price. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 114 points, 2/3%, to close at 16,528. The NASDAQ was off 51 points, more than 1%, to finish at 4776. The S&P 500 fell 16 points, 0.8%, to end the day at 1972. It's the first day of the week, but the last day of the month. In August, the Dow fell 6.6%, the NASDAQ fell 6.9%, and the S&P fell 6.3%. That is the biggest monthly drop for the Dow since May 2010, if you're keeping track of that sort of thing, and the biggest monthly drop for the NASDAQ and S&P since May 2012. Now, the energy sector was something of a bright spot on the day. Whiting Petroleum up 9.8%. Stone Energy Corp up 11.1%. Shares in Phillips 66 climbed 2 1/3% on word that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway owns nearly $4.5 billion stake in the oil refiner. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.21%. And you are listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Wall Street is all over the place. Wages are stagnant. Consumer confidence is best described as eh. And no one is feeling the pain of this economic roller coaster more than local businesses. Steve Presser owns a toy store in Cleveland, Ohio. It's called Big Fun Toy Store. We check in on him from time to time. And after the recent stock market dips and concerns about China's economy, we wanted to see how small business is faring. Thanks for coming on, Steve.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
So let's start with the basics. How is business?
It's a sigh. It depends geographically. I've got a store here in Cleveland Heights, and I have a store in Columbus, and a little bit of a different picture in both parts, depending on what part of the state you're in. It's good down in Columbus. It's not as strong here where I'm at.
Are you noticing, you know, I'm reading that there are retail trends about people really, really comparing prices, really doing a lot of price comparison shopping and then sometimes ending up online. Do you think you're seeing some of that?
Oh, absolutely. That trend has become not just a trend. It's become a fact of the matter. I've watched people do what they call showrooming, where they come in and with an application on their phone, their smartphone, they take a photo of my product and they check prices instantaneously. So we've seen quite a move towards that. And it, as a brick and mortar, it's very frustrating.
I bet. How do you compete with the internet, whether it's that price checking or the prices themselves? Is there a way to make your shopping experience more unique and enticing?
As my mother would say, kill them with kindness. I just, you know, we've always been a niche business, and so a lot of our product you just can't readily find online. But you just want to hope that people understand that the local mom-and-pop brick-and-mortar store has been here for years, has supported the community. They're your friends, they're family members, your kids play soccer with your kids. And so we hope that that has some kind of equitable value when it comes to buying an item.
And what are the other factors that are impacting your business? Is China causing problems for you?
We see a little bit of that. You know, again, psychologically, that seems to be the biggest effect for us. When people hear that China is shutting down, they're not sending out as much product, or there's inferior product coming from China, or the stock market is dropping precipitously, that has a psychological effect on our customers. And so, you know, they've been pre-warned. They have this perception that things are going to happen before they even walk into our doors. The China effect for someone like me who sells, you know, toys, novelties, collectibles, we don't feel that immediately, but there is the story, you know, the slow boat from China. And so when we're waiting for product and it just doesn't come in, you know, it's frustrating for our customers. So we have to wait like everybody else. And then therefore, if it's not there, we hope that our customers will find something that's funky and cool in our store to substitute.
Yeah. Steve, what do you think the next few months look like for you?
Well, hopefully they'll be good. We kind of lost our Halloween season because of all the pop-up Halloween stores around the country that have moved in to just stay open for, you know, 8 weeks and take business from us. I hate to sound like a sourpuss, but it's reality. But our big business is Christmas time and the holiday season. So we're in a lull right now. The back-to-school business, it tails off for us. There's other things that the parents want to get for their kids, like books and clothes. But coming into Christmas season, I'm an eternal optimist. I'm hoping we're going to have a very strong season. We offer something that's different. So I think you have to be a niche market these days.
Steve Presser, thanks so much for joining us and best of luck.
Molly, thanks so much.
Okay, I think I've asked enough questions for today. Time to hear some questions from you in a segment we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
For today's installment, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman answers this question about the proverbial traveling band.
The question comes from Connor Cox. He's a digital marketing guy.
I've always wondered how band managers decide which cities and which venues to book their touring acts.
Cox lives in San Diego, and he says they get no respect down there at the bottom left of the country.
On U2's last tour, they played Los Angeles, but they didn't even stop in San Diego. Sometimes we're just a second thought.
Well, I can't tell you why U2 dissed your hometown, but I am going to try to explain the economics of band tours.
The latest record is called Ragged and Dirty. You can get it here. This is called Back to You.
Blues rocker Devin Allman, son of the famous Southern rocker Greg Allman, is on tour with his band this summer.
I've been running through the fiends, man.
I sat down with Allman backstage before his gig at a big blues festival in Portland, Oregon. It's a sweltering four-day beer-drenched extravaganza. He was set to go on in a couple hours.
As we get about 10 minutes, then it gets exciting. I don't get nervous, I just get stoked. Like, I really get pumped. Especially festival crowds. It's just such good energy.
After his set, he took the festival stage with his father, Greg, a nice bump for a mid-tier artist like Devin. Plus, there's this.
Festivals, they are good money.
Jill Kettles is Allman's publicist. A single festival can pay thousands of dollars. The hotel's nice, the audience is big, and you don't have to sweat too hard to bring them in. Kettles says the festivals are what you put up on the calendar first. They're the anchor dates.
Anchor dates can also be big cities like New York, Washington, Chicago, Dallas, and then you fill in with the Davenports and the Toledos, the Daytons, you know, whatever.
Connecting those dots on the tour, that's harder. Should it be Davenport or Iowa City or maybe Louisville? You want those mid-sized venues to be a few hours' drive for the band vans in places where you hope the band has some fans. And some of those gigs are going to be in the middle of the week, Tuesday or Wednesday night, when clubs don't sell so many tickets. This can be a disaster.
Played for 50 people? Oh, yeah. You always end up playing for the sound man, the bartender, and the waitress at one point. And it is sort of disheartening.
And costly. Because the way it typically works, the venue pays the band a base amount. It's called the guarantee. A few $100 for a small club, $1,000 or more for a bigger one. The artist then often gets a percentage of ticket sales in addition over what the venue takes for its expenses and profit. A half-empty house, the band's paycheck may not even cover hotel, food, gas, and the cost of the crew. Gabe Johnson books tours for mid-sized bands, and we sat down at a coffee shop in Portland after his own funk band had played a show.
It's, as it were, the crunch on the middle class, very strongly in the music industry.
It's the crunch on the middle class band.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to make ends meet.
Johnson says a band that's opening for a bigger act may just get $250 or $300 per gig. Still, the tour could be worth it to build buzz, sell merch, and get folks to, God forbid, pay to download their music later. He remembers one up-and-coming band.
Got an opportunity to open up on a national tour for one of the heaviest hitters in Bluegrass Americana, and it's opened up all of the East Coast markets to them. It was undoubtedly the best plan, but they lost like 8-10 grand in a month. At least.
So for all those folks whose favorite artists pass them by, here's the deal. Where the band goes is about the money, but it's also about where the artist wants exposure, even if the money's not so great. And the place you live may not offer enough money or exposure to be worth the stop on the tour. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is one of those segments that doesn't work without you. We need to know what you've always wondered about. So please tell us at marketplace.org. And this final note before we go, a little more on the president's visit to Alaska. While he's up there, Mr. Obama will reportedly tape an episode of the survival reality show Running Wild with Bear Grylls. The show often has celebrities and other guests come on, and it puts them through sort of a survivalist boot camp. Backcountry adventures, eating bugs, drinking your own urine, that sort of thing. The special episode of the show will air later this year. A press release about the appearance said Obama will meet with Grylls to evaluate the effects of climate change on the state of Alaska. He'll do some hiking on a glacier, and he will reportedly test his survival skills. At least a little bit. The White House press secretary told reporters this week that some of the ideas suggested by Bear Grylls and his team were not approved by the Secret Service. But here's hoping the president eats a bug or two. We've got a new episode of our Corner Office podcast out now. It's Kai Ryssdal's full conversation with Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky at that company's headquarters in San Francisco. Airbnb is now valued at over $25 billion, but Chesky says starting it 6 years ago might have been the worst idea to ever work. Download it wherever you podcast. All right, that's Marketplace. Thank you for listening. Today, the Dow was down 114 points, or 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 51 points, more than 1%. And the S&P 500 fell 16 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood. Marketplace will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.